What's up, everybody? Happy Friday. Y'all, this is a current record. This is 2 months in a row. We are
Wow.
on top of it here. Y'all, it is Friday. We are live, which means it is time for another round of Friday Night Frights. As you may or may not know, we cycle through different topics and cover different things every single month, switch it up, all of that jazz. And this month, we are talking about an interesting figure in the history of Christianity in Padre Pio. This is a name that I can tie back to my love of horror and strange TV growing up, because I am of the original Unsolved Mysteries generation. So my first time hearing about Padre Pio was when they did a segment on him. Just one of those, like, they did, crazy that a couple of 30 somethings would be doing a live stream that has segments about a variety of different strange and weird things. And so you get these ideas from someplace. And so Unsolved Mysteries, religious weirdness, this that was the first time. And that kind of stuff growing up in a I'll call it spiritually aware household. That sort of thing, like, it wasn't like I was like a Catholic or even or Christian or in a Christian household, but the idea of all of these different miracles and weird phenomena happening around this guy, especially because horror in the 70s in the 80s, which is what I grew up on, really likes using stigmata as a form of religious weirdness. Like, that's a thing in that era of horror, and specifically like proto paranormal horror, you know what I mean? So Christian, what's your first introduction to Padre Pio?
Would have been a couple of years ago, just randomly looking through some, like, top 10 articles of people who claimed saints who claimed to have done whatever, and looking at him, and I remember the briefly looking over that, but I haven't like done a deep dive into this. So like I'm a student today. I've read some of this stuff, but like a lot of what is in what you research for this, I'm here to learn. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I joking I jokingly say that stuff like Unsolved Mysteries and stuff like that is part of why I have a deep appreciation for our Catholic brothers and sisters. I myself am not a professing Catholic, but in order to navigate today's waters, you gotta be cool with the fact that we're talking about Catholicism and we're talking about Catholic rituals and things like that. So for anybody who's tracking along with us this evening, that is going to be the main area, because that's the idea, right? The Padre Pio is a figure that is one of, if you are kind of in the know, Padre Pio is one of the central names within like miracles and things like that. And the thing is it's not ancient folklore, because you think about you talk about somebody like Padre Pio, especially when we get to all of the stuff with the miracles and all of that. It sounds like there's all of this time that's passed, but this is the 1900s. There's witnesses, there's investigations, there's published reports, and there is controversy that never really fully went away, as you would expect when you're talking about this sort of thing. The core mystery is really the volume of the claims. He's by far and away not the first part of the priesthood to experience, miraculous sign, all of that sort of stuff. But by volume, this is on a kind of on a different level. You're talking about stigmata more than once, healings, bilocation reports, unusual knowledge in confession, and a worldwide devotion and following that grew posthumously. So we start off with the early days. His real name, or his given name, is Francesco Forgione. I'm not gonna do, you can for anybody who understands that we're gonna be saying a lot of Italian names, and you're bound to hear the stupid accent. You can rest assured, I'd rather butcher a name than do the stupid accent. I promise you, I'm not gonna do it. So May 25th, 1887, in Petrachina, in the south of Italy, and he's baptized right after his birth, and by the age of 12, he had received confirmation and first communion, both Catholic rituals and rites. And on January 6, 1903, he enters the Capuchin sect in Morcone, and on the 22nd receives the habit and the name Brother Pio, because names were a given name is given in that process. So he makes his solemn profession on January 27th, 1907. So we sit in the year of our Lord 2026 currently. So we're not talking about ancient history. Like I said, this is somebody that is very real, had a very real path to the papacy that we can chart out, and others would chart out as the story and the legend unfolds about his life. One of the two kind of hand-in-hand attributes of Padre Pio that would really define the majority of his life would be ongoing health issues and an unwavering, unshakable commitment to service of others and care for others. He was a man that cared very much about, like, spoke very openly about the care to the entire church, and a lot of people saw that as kind of this suffering saint sort of thing, like a man that had this level of devotion that went through the things that he went through. There are some people that sit on the side on the side of, I think we should scrutinize Padre Pio more than we do. They will commonly cite the fact that he is a man that there are a lot of pieces that can add to the lore and can add to kind of the grandness of his name that would do him a lot of favors as he would go on in his life. After that, he's ordained in 1910, and stays with his family until 1916. He In World War I, he was drafted into the Italian army as a medic, and is repeatedly discharged and recalled because of, again, poor health, until he's declared unfit and permanently discharged in March of 1918. There's a the common belief is that his health issues were connected to tuberculosis. And
That makes a
so
lot of sense to me.
being
At this time in history, World War I, Italy, even though it's on the side of the Allies, it does not do really well against the Austro-Hungarian Empire. They had some really bad leadership, and the fact that they would bring someone back multiple times over after medically discharging them makes perfect sense to me because they needed bodies.
That's about it. You were a body at that point. And, you know, but a lot of people will cite the fact that somebody like Pio is the perfect person to fill that spot because he is a person who's given towards commitment and, you know, being called back constantly like that. He would do it, you know. And so it's interesting because you look at one of the things that stands out to me when you go through a very unassuming background, right? So like grows up, health concerns, takes a habit, gets ordained, the whole nine yards, and then like everybody of that time frame, you know, you're getting drafted into the war. And this figure that's kind of larger than life in a lot of respects, and that a lot of people have a lot of deep devotion to, like generationally within families, because you have people that are like the kids or grandkids or great great grandkids at this point, you know, telling stories about or hearing stories about how this figure prayed over, did this thing, and like their family member was healed, this person was affected, and all of that sort of stuff. And so you have this ongoing generational belief in this man as the real McCoy. You know, if you're going to believe that these things are possible, then within Catholicism you're talking about that the priesthood being, for lack of a better phrase, the direct connection, which is exactly why you get the practice of sainthood and, you know, canonizing and all of that sort of jazz. It's just, it's the mentality, regardless of what you think about it, regardless of if you think it's right, wrong, or indifferent. And so he's ordained, like I said, 1910, and in 1916 he's sent to the Capuchin Friary in San Giovanni Rotondo, which is a central location basically for the rest of his life. From that point forward, the friary becomes a magnet. People travel there for mass and for confession and for counsel, and eventually they believe that something extraordinary is happening at this location. This claim basically is turning a friar into a Christian celebrity in a lot of regards. He's already becoming kind of this international phenomenon.
I mean, you have someone who seems to be a very charismatic person, who is able to, you know, get a crowd not riled up, but like get into what he's actually saying. And naturally, he's going to become his name is going to be known elsewhere, and people are going to flock and see what's he about. So yeah, this also makes perfect sense to me. Like, you have someone clearly gifted, and before the miracles happen, this is occurring. So that tells me like they were seeing something before the supernatural showed up. And I would argue, yeah, it was still supernatural, you know, if he's actually professing the word and all that matter. But then that would attract people that way. But like the fame and glory hasn't happened because of the miracles yet. I mean, sure, there'll be some down the road, but right here and now, it's based on his character and his ability to work on a crowd and to preach well and minister to people well.
Exactly. And that's where I think this becomes interesting, because like from here we're gonna get into the miracles. But before we do, I think you raise a really good point that there's evidence that this man is already drawing a crowd for Jesus. You know what I mean? Like people, but when you hear the stories, you often hear, especially you're talking about, I first heard about Padre Pio 30-ish years ago. What and again, you're talking about the 1990s in relation to when this stuff has was happening
Yes.
in real time. And so again, not ancient history. And a lot of what people would say is that there was like this gravity to towards him, that he had this presence, and he there was this feeling that people would talk about of just being drawn in by him, by being wanting to quote unquote be close to the fire, for my more charismatic friends that are out there, you know what I mean? And so and I think that's interesting, because you can you we again, we will get to the more bombastic stuff, but at some point we have to approach this in the same posture that we would approach anything that we talk about here on Friday Night Frights, right? Because we have said, for those of you that are uninitiated, because everybody's episode is there, or every episode is somebody's first episode, and
The
so
Marvel
we
Method.
have talked, yeah, exactly, we have talked about some weird stuff on the show, and we've had a variety of positions on all of it. Sometimes I think it's all hogwash, and Christian's like, I don't know about that. And other times I'm like, it's all real. I want it all to be real. Shout out to our friends and that documentary. I don't even remember the name of that. I'm
Hellier.
blanking on the name. Yeah, Hellier. Shout out to our friends over at Hellier. I just want it all to be real. You know what I mean? Like, and we go back and forth, but at some point, if you're gonna entertain this stuff, you've got to come forward with it and start asking the question, okay, even so let's let in the supernatural into the conversation. Like, let's leave that door open as a potentially satisfactory answer. So, as two people trained in the pastorate, we kind of like we are preaching about a dude who came back to life. Like, that's where we start the conversation. And
Bare
so
minimum.
if yeah and so if we are talking about men of God, like the priesthood, like people who are like, you don't know the man's heart, so you got to come forward with an air of grace, right? So like, this dude's dedicated, he's devoted, he fundamentally believes the whole nine yards. So by scriptural standards, the Holy Spirit's involved. So the idea of somebody who gets the gimmick about love God with all of your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and then also gets love your neighbor as yourself. Like, we can go 12 rounds with a ref about all the denominational stuff, but I'm talking about fundamentals as it relates to the Bible. If that is what is happening, why is it outside the realm of conception to say that this man is operating in the spirit, and because he's operating in the spirit, he's drawing a crowd. He's enigmatic, he's charismatic. And I do think that there's room in the conversation of, before I was a Christian, I was learning how to talk from people like Andrew Dice Clay and Muhammad Ali, and you know what I mean? Like, I was learning how to speak on the microphone, and how to present myself as an on-air entertainment, and all of that sort of jazz. So like it's not like skill sets start at the moment that we become Christians or something along those lines. So like, there is a measure of personal skill and passion and presentation that has to be considered in all of this. But why is it outside the realm of belief to say that the Holy Spirit came in and turned the volume up to 11 and said, come one, come all? You know what I mean? Especially if this dude's gonna be ground zero for all manner of miraculous nonsense that's about to take place.
There's something to be said here. Multiple things. I think there is a section of the audience out there who are cessationists in their beliefs. For those in the big churchy words, cessationism is the idea that spiritual gifts were in the Bible. I mean, like the more supernatural ones, they happen there, the healing and miracle making and all that. But then after the apostolic age, they ceased. There was no reason for them to be. I am not a cessationist. I can understand why someone would go that way. And then the moment something like this comes up, they automatically they have their out. Well, these don't happen anymore, so this can't be true. I am a continuationist. I do believe that these things can occur if God so wills. If he wants someone to heal someone, the gift of healing can be there. That could even be their primary gift. I don't know. So that's something to be brought up. Also, as well, you probably figured out we're Protestant. You know, many jokes have been made at Joe's expense of being a Catholic in disguise or whatever. But like, he's very, as Protestant as I. We don't agree on everything. Don't get me wrong. That's how truly Protestant we are at the end of the day. But so we are approaching this with our preconceptions of a Protestant lens. We're doing our best to understand things from a Catholic lens. Like we both studied the denomination. We both studied the rituals and the hierarchy and everything involved there. So if we get something wrong, that's not our intent. We're not trying to like misattribute something just to make Catholicism look bad or anything like that. So that's on the table. I had something else I wanted to add. We may use the word cult today to describe the people who venerate Padre Pio. And I know if you're out there in the world, Christian or not, cult means bad. Well, 99% of the time. And the Catholic side of things, a cult, when it is devoted to a saint, is the idea of showing reverence towards them and calling out, hey, this is what they're about. We're going to make sure people know about who they are. It's not, they're not worshiping the saint. And I know that's many Protestants out there who would throw the accusation out. That's not what's going out here. So is there anything else you can think about before we move on? That, like, we might need to like nip in the bud here.
I think that's about those are the biggest ones. You know, everything that's said is said in good faith. Even if it's wrong, it's said in good is said in good faith. So please feel free to correct us. It's not that we're not trying to take the correction. We will happily take it. But it's not said out of any sorts of malice. But yeah. So. It is good, like, and that today's that's today's word lesson and today's reminder that words mean things and understand that words can mean different things in different situations. So if you come into the comments talking about we're calling Catholics cults, then I understand that you skipped past that part. So you know, I do think that there's enough room to say, even if, and I don't, I definitely had a misunderstanding at different points about what exactly cessationists believe. I've had some very insightful conversations with different cessationists, so I can get like a more well-rounded view on the matter and all of that. I do not in any way, shape, or form cannot like. No, you know what I mean. Like, I don't agree with it at all. But I can at least say, it's not like they're mustache twirling. For all of our charismatic friends out there, or even for our continuous friends that aren't charismatic, please understand that they're not mustache twirling either. But
yes,
yeah, I mean, all of this, it seems like the perfect groundwork. If I'm being honest, like just looking at like this is the presentation of the man. That this all makes a lot of sense. So if you guys, if this is your first episode of Friday Night Frights, one thing that we talk about a lot, especially when you're talking about things like paranormal, different things like that, anything like supernatural or even like cryptids, documentation is something that you have to give respect to in relation to the time period that you're talking about. You cannot go into even the early to, you know, 20s, 30s of the 1900s and expect documentation at the level of a 2026. That's not operating within the paradigm of a realistic point of view. And so one of the things that comes up a lot is, man, sometimes a legend is born at right the right time for it to become a legend. You can talk about all the gravity in the world that it has, but a legend is still a legend, and the legend is still helped by happening in a time where only a certain amount of documentation was available at the time. You know, it's one thing when it's all word of mouth and you don't have anything. You know, like we've talked about cases like that. We've talked about situations like that where like it's completely removed from a time period where there was really well done documentation. This isn't that, even though it's not the modern day. There is definitely a certain measure of documentation now at this point, as evidenced by all of the accounts of the miracles, but time frame still matters. And so I think Padre Pio is benefited by having been active in the time that he was. And I do think that word of mouth is a significant piece of the puzzle here when you're talking about a Catholic saint among other Catholic saints. I'm not like a PhD on Catholic saints or anything, but I also understand that this is a guy that really had cast a big shadow in sainthood. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And one thing I give the Catholic Church a lot of credit on is that when it comes to things like this, and we're going to see it later on, is that they take these things very seriously. If they're going to make someone and nominate someone a saint, they're going to investigate the heck out of it to make sure that there is no trickery, to make sure that it's not just people saying it because they want someone to be a saint, because they were a really good Christian. And they just, it'd be nice if they were, venerated as such. Because, scandals could happen. There are plenty of other scandals in the Catholic Church, plenty of other scandals in every church. But like for something like this to come out and it be false, they're risking a lot. And I know of several events. I can't list them off because proper nouns are not coming to me right now. But the 40, 50 years ago of potential miracles and potential candidates for sainthood, they're still discussing to this day because they want to be sure. Like there's that instinct of like, oh, we want. This is a good thing. It's proof of the power of God, proof that he's on our side and all this. But like, what is it? Let's make sure first. And they are very stringent about this.
And that's, but I think that again, to your credit, I'll echo what you said. When you're talking about signs and miracles, and trying to articulate it within the realm of authenticity, I love them or hate them or somewhere in between, the Catholic Church is the one that's leading the pack when it comes when it comes to that. And I think
Yes.
that whether you're talking about religious weirdness or you're talking about paranormal or you're talking about some other form of supernatural research, your research, take it from an old head. I've been around the block, y'all. Don't be afraid of critique, because when your critique comes back clean and there's no notes, then you got the real McCoy. But we have to get away from a mentality that every time at bat, you're gonna, find a sign of miracle. You're gonna find, an act of God and all of that sort of stuff. I think there's something special about all of this that it is not free from scrutiny, even
Oh,
during the man's
absolutely.
life.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, just because something's been studied immensely and has a lot of times has been on it doesn't mean that it is going to be truth at the end of the day. There's human error, or there could be personal feelings that get in the way and say they really want it to be true. I'm not saying that's just because they've studied it, it automatically. I don't know if that's what not you were saying about what I was saying, but like just because it's been studied doesn't mean it is an absolute. Like there could be something that went wrong along the way. You trusted the wrong person. That could be true. That so when it's coming to these things, just sit back, hear what happens, and make your own judgments.
Now, We're going to get into some of the notable miracles. Honestly, there's really like a lot of when it comes to them. So we're going to be hitting some of the high notes where this is not an extensive list. But we are going to start with likely the spiciest of the attributed miracles, and that's the stigmata. Like I said, at the beginning, it's actually twice that two different instances that are associated with him. And so for those of you that don't know, the sign of the stigmata are essentially the wounds of Christ. They show up on a human being. They come out of nowhere, and they basically come they come quickly and sometimes stick around, sometimes go quickly, kind of varies on account to account. So the first one was 1910, and then again in 1918. And the wounds from 1918 are the ones that are said to have remained up until his death. That 1918 date is basically a hinge point for a lot of the stuff that happens within, the extreme acknowledgement of him and his growing popularity and fame and the widespread recognition of the man. There's a widely cited account that says that he was in the church choir after mass in prayer when he experienced a vision of Christ crucified and then noticed the bleeding wounds. Now, the actual wounds themselves, they can be substantiated. Investigators recorded descriptions when they interviewed him as a part of formal inquiries on the man. So investigators, when they documented the wounds, early investigators involved Bishop Raphael Rossi, who was commissioned by the Holy Office to make a canonical inquiry. Accounts tied to Rossi's report describe the wounds as open and bloody, not infected in the expected way, and not closing at all. One detail that gets repeated from a lot of summaries of that investigation is that the side wound is distinct, that it's almost triangular in shape, which would be the shape of a spear wound. Another detail that becomes essentially fuel for the legend is that reports describe a floral type odor that were associated with the wounds. And a lot of this was either it was documented, but it was also handled in a way as it was happening. It was unprecedented because the man was still alive, and like at that point there was such a growth in his notoriety that this is where you'd start to get periods of time where he was actually quarantined away from mass groups of people because they couldn't handle the volume of people that were coming in, and they were looking to investigate the actual, the actual wounds and the claims and all of that sort of stuff. As it all became new, more known, more people would come around, and Capuchin sources say that he wore gloves to cover the marks on his hands, partly for modesty and partly because the wounds caused pain. And that the glove detail is significant because it becomes part of the public image. People associate him with hidden wounds and not with grand spectacle. And sources also report that at the time of his death in 1968, the stigmata had disappeared and doctors found no scars where the wounds had been. So, whether or not you believe that they're miraculous, the reality is that it's documented that they existed. And it's at least reported that at some point in time they ended. And so, if it's not miraculous, then you basically have to default to somebody's lying about something. And so, again, in good faith to what Catholics would believe is a thing. Do I think it's possible? Yeah, I think it's possible. I think somebody speaking in tongues could be possible. I think somebody touching another person and being wholly and completely healed is possible. I think it's all possible. I've just never seen it. Yeah, I'd say the same thing about somebody speaking in tongues accurately right in front of me. I've never seen it in person. I've been around healing, but the other ones, n no. So I would categorize this in exactly that spot.
Yeah, stigmata is one of those words that just puts my Protestant senses on overdrive. They tingle really hard because I always end up, I think the first time I ever heard it was in like one of those Mysteries of the Unexplained books or whatever, like Reader's Digest or Time that put out, I can't remember which one. And I was like reading this as like a 12, 13-year-old Baptist kid and going, what is this? I don't get it. This makes no sense to me. And then, like, as I've aged, I've still wrestled with it because I don't know. Because this is not an isolated incident. Like many other Catholic priests and even just Catholic men and women across the years have experienced something similar to this. So, am I going to say that they're all liars simply because it makes me feel bad or confused? No, I can't do that out of hand because that's not being intellectually honest to what's happening here, or even spiritually honest, if I'm going to be honest. So what do we do with this? Is this man just a fake? It just because I don't get it. It's kind of what breaks my mind is like, why? Why would this be the sign that shows up? Why would God, Jesus, Holy Spirit, whichever the three in one is working in here, make this happen to one of their children? What is to be gained from this? And that makes me go, I don't understand. I don't get it. Is it just because I'm out of, that ball field and I'm playing in another one that it'll never make sense to me? Maybe. But like, I can't imagine inflicting that on one of your servants. But I don't also discount it out of hand simply because I can't get there yet. So when it's happening here, when it with him specifically, there's also that whole you can just have the skeptic say, oh, it's really convenient at the end of his life, that these weren't there. They healed miraculously, even though you have multiple people over his life, like say they were there, I could see them, he wore the gloves. And what really strikes me as great in this is that if this is actually happening, if it is true, it's not just showmanship, he covers them up out of like humility to not make it about him, if that's what's happening. Because I don't discount that he could be faking it for the sake of bringing people there and then showing a false humility. I don't want to believe that, if a man of the cloth, but I have to put it out there. And I know, of course, there's going to be that other side that's going to say, oh, well, obviously it's demonic in nature because they're not the real church anyways, and they're just trying to bring people away from the truth. And you know what? I can't, in and of itself, discount demonic activity, but I see no further evidence of this from what I have researched to then say that it had to be a demon because people just want to say that it's like their cop out, like in the cessationist sense of, well, it's not happening, therefore it can't happen. or obviously they're wrong, so therefore it had to be a demon or an alien or whoever, whatever. Just a insert thing here that doesn't make me have to think about what's happening.
And you know, I think the more experience that I garner, and the more groups that I kind of intersect with, the more I come to think that God operates at the frequency of the human or the group that he's talking to or that he's operating with. And in our Protestant minds, most people who grew up Protestant, most people that have been a part of the church in America for a long time, are very disconnected from any idea of martyrdom, any idea of saints, people that have reverence to them. And likewise, there is a certain disconnect with the supernatural, with this idea of movements, grand movements of the spirit. And so seeing a Protestant seeing the stigmata, more likely than not, more often than not, is not going to have the same impact of somebody who is a part of the Catholic Church seeing that. I think that's something that at least deserves to be on the table for the conversation. I will say this in very, very openly, again, Protestant, mainly for one very specific reason, though. It's how I read the book of Acts. Because if the idea here is that the Catholic Church is the one that dates all the way back to Peter, and that the only people that are like that's the lineage, and that it only that it only looks this certain way, then why was most of what we see in the book of Acts happening in alleyways and homes? You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't happening in the synagogue, it wasn't happening in the temple, it wasn't happening in the grand meeting places. It was happening in little pockets all over the place. That's literally what we're watching Paul do for like the run of his time writing the New Testament. And a big part of that for me comes down to, I think, if it were not for some of the very, very specific portions of Roman Catholicism, there is absolutely a not zero chance that I would that I would deem myself a Catholic, just not a Roman Catholic. And so that's kind of where I'm at. So you'll hear kind of a different flavor come out of me, where I'm gonna look at this and I'm gonna say, no, I think there's something to the lineage of Peter. Gotta divorce ourselves away from the power structures. We gotta divorce ourselves away from the papacy. I'm sorry, I'll never submit to the papacy. That's one of the biggest differentiations between myself and my Catholic brothers and sisters. Do I think that there have been wonderful popes over the time of memoriam? Absolutely. It's not all evil, it's not all this, it's not all that, it's not any of that. But I don't see a precedent. And I include with Peter in that for a papacy, a pope, and all of that sort of jazz. And so, but I do think that our Catholic brothers and sisters can teach us something when talking about how God can move and what's possible. Because like, I'm not down with the metaphysics of communion. I'm not down with transubstantiation. I'm just not. But I do again, what if you dared to look at it and say, what if God could move like this? What if the supernatural this? What if this? And again, like having worked with different groups of people from across the world, What we think of as spiritual warfare in America is not what other countries would deem spiritual warfare for them. And the problem is that we live in a very tribalized country, and it's very hard to get a word in edgewise without provoking somebody who wants to grandstand about any of these topics. And so it's very hard to have intelligent conversation about these things. But I think when you're talking about the stigmata, so one of the common the common rebuttals that some investigators would say, or some reporters would say, is that he was dumping like basically like an acidic compound on his hands, and that's how they were staying open. I like we're not talking about the Stone Age, guys. Like, I just don't think that I think that if you don't want to see something, you're not gonna see something. And at some point, you have to ask the question. If you're looking at this picture and you've got to flip your the picture off on its side, and you got to step on one leg, and you got to squint real hard, and then you'll see a ghost orb, and you'll see the face of your dear Aunt Sally in the photo. Like, at what point are we just doing gymnastics for the sake of wanting to avoid what's right in front of our face? And at some point, I think you have to ask the question: is my bias causing more questioning? Or am I still operating within a paradigm that I am trying to be authentic to what's actually happening?
Yeah, you raise a great point there, because I'd also seen the acid thing. And I couldn't help but think of how stupid that would be. Like, I'm not saying it couldn't have
Seriously.
happened, but like, we are at 1918, 9 to 10 years away from penicillin being developed. Like, do you know how many people died of open wounds from like really small cuts back in the day? And you want to tell me he put that on both hands and feet and every on his sides too? Like, I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm saying, like, think critically for a moment here. Are you willing to go that far for a scam?
Especially a scam that's not gen like so again, I think part of this sits at the level of there are in this country two groups of people within Christianity that usually catch the most amount of strays and tend to be two groups that are the most misunderstood, and it's Catholics and Jews. That's just the reality of it. There in America, we have a very real anti-Catholic, anti-Semitic leaning. And at some point, you have to ask the question: are you playing into the stereotype that the Catholic Church just wants your money? Are you playing into the stereotype that all Catholics are bad, or all Catholics are greedy, or whatever? And are you willing to expose those thoughts to the reality that somebody else looks at you and says, "Oh, all Christians are like that"? They don't know enough to make the differentiation between Catholic. It's all the same to them, which is fascinating, because people who don't practice the faith get more things right than people who practice the faith sometimes in this country. And so
Yeah, go ahead.
when so 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 possible? Okay. I spoke at the beginning. We have to keep the door open. We have to think, we have to be willing to allow the door to remain open if there's not the ground to absolutely close it, even on the things that we disagree with and things like that. Do I think that the most uneducated answer is acid on the wounds? Because I just don't like it. I have no words. I have no articulate words. But like, that to me needs to sit. If it were just a dude, if it were just a priest without any of the other pieces, and the stigmata is happening, I don't think that it comes under as much scrutiny. I think it's when you start to build it out with also the fact that you have all of these different healings that are reported and attributed to him. Some during his life, there are many that are attributed to him posthumously through intercession. Now we're gonna have to have an educational moment here for a second because it's going to piggyback off of something that Christian said before and why he said it. So it's not that Catholics worship saints, it's that there is this idea of intercessory prayer, which is a biblical concept. And so intercessory prayer is where the dialogue between Christian and saint happens. It's that you are petitioning this saint to intercede on your behalf. And like again, you could sit at that level and have all of your facts right and still say nope. And cool, whatever. Like do you. I'm not here to force anybody to think that that's how it works. I'm just saying, in a world where we only see a candle through a fabric lens, we only see a shadow, we only see a fragment, we only see a piece of the greater whole. Are you really, really willing to get that confident about saying that that's not how it works? I'm just saying. You can have opinions, but willing to die on the hill? I don't think so, Tim.
It's something else you said earlier. It's an idea I had, but I don't think I'd ever like vocalized it to myself when it came to like, hearing stories of saints coming down in a vision to someone to get them to do something, or like the Mary showing up to reveal a prophecy or something like that. And many Catholic retellings of different, stories like that. And the idea being of, I can't remember exactly how you word it, but God knowing his people, is this a way for him to directly go to them in a way they would, in a context they would understand based on the teaching they've received? Could he use a saint to come to them? Could he use his own mother to come to them in this way? Because they would go, oh, based on my preconceptions, I'm already gravitating towards this. So you can do something mighty, God, but now it's better to me. It's easier for me to get it because I get this idea. Like I've been taught this idea growing up. Like, so maybe a stigmata would work far more effectively in a Catholic setting versus if it happened in my church, where I think that would really cause problems with a lot of people. Like I think, and God is not a God of confusion. So I think that would be a part of it there. So I thank you for helping to like actually put that into words, to something that I can get and grasp of like, okay, he's never going to show that to me. But he could show that to someone else who has this context. I don't.
So I one of the big things that opened the door for that mode of thought for me was my come to Jesus moment. So very sick, half dead, like questioning whether or not I was going to make it sort of deal. And I'm in the nosebleeds of this mega church auditorium style, and the all this dude comes on the stage, and I gathered that he's like the heir apparent. He's the one who's going to take over the throne once the senior pastor retires, and he's going to be the guy for like all of the satellites and all the things and all the such senior pastor. He's everything to lose by getting on the stage and being like, I doubt sometimes that God is real. I know the game, and I'm just like, this is you have everything. You're like late 30s, early 40s. Like, you can say what you will, but if you're talking about actually making money as a pastor, that's how you do it. Like, that's one of the only ways. Take my word for it. But it's hearing that, and then the setting, and then I'm kneeling up there, and I have this supernatural experience, and I can describe the physical sensations, I can describe all of it. And I still had the moment afterwards of like, yo, my brain could have fabricated that entire thing because of how sick I am. Like that's an actual thing. Like that's not just empty skepticism. That's like
Yes.
actually documented scientific evidence that the brain does wild, wild stuff when going into like protection mode and all of that sort of jazz. And so that was the time where I was like, well, everybody says I wish I had my burning bush moment, right? That's a thing you'll hear a lot. Oh,
Yes.
crying out loud, I had about as close to a burning bush moment as you get. And I still fell back on my heels and said, is this real? And then when I coupled that with my experiences of hearing from different people in different parts of the world, because during my time as a Christian and during my time as a pastor, I have been blessed to be deeply ingrained in international ministry. And hearing the different stories and hearing the different rhythms and all of that sort of stuff, you realize you gotta look for the beats. You gotta look for the temples, because it's going to look wildly different. And at some point, you have to ask the question, am I really going to call everybody a liar because their situation doesn't fit my situation? Or am I going to make enough room and allow my God to be big enough to say, oh, well, maybe the answer is that my context, it's not going to, he could do something to me that I'm not going to understand. And it's going to throw me for a loop where they do it to somebody in another country. And it's like, oh, that makes all of the sense in the world. And this is a direct sign from God and all of that and all of that sort of jazz. And I would even say, like, I would still give that to the idea, I would still give that measure of grace to the idea of an intercessory relationship with the saints. And that's I understand for some, even that is like, seriously, Christian, when did you start doing a show with a closet Catholic? Like, come out of the closet already. You're a Catholic. I get it. I just won't submit. And that's like, but again, that's why I honestly had a conversation with the Orthodox Church as well. Like, it wasn't just Catholicism that I had an honest conversation about, because I'm like, dude, if everybody and their mother is telling me that I'm a Catholic, am I the last one to figure this out? You know what I mean? Like that sort of thing. And so like I hear what I'm saying too, y'all, but like I don't know. Like I'm not I'll say it like this. I am at least unconfident enough to say that I'm willing to die on the hill that this isn't happening. I
Yes.
dare and I challenge any English professor to go to the whiteboard right now and diagram that sentence that I just said. Anyway.
Yeah. But, well, I appreciate that. Just being honest about your journey. I think that'll be really helpful. I mean, it's helpful for me to hear, for everyone listening too. It's like, okay, yeah, this is where you're coming from in this regard. And yeah, how many times have I asked for a burning bush and it be given to me? And I go, I don't know about that. I get real Gideon about it. Yeah, I'm with you.
And so I think I think when you're looking at something like this, I think when you're looking at this idea of healings, especially when you're talking about ones that have stood up to scrutiny, and you're talking about his beautification documentation and his canonization, and these are layers that sit within an additional huge number of reported healings, and you have to say, like, is it okay? So what if his posthumous stuff is not like intercessory? Okay,
Posthumous.
I still think that you have to give room to the movement of the Holy Spirit, and I would wager that you're not doing anything that he wasn't doing himself. because you're talking about a dude that by each standard, by each account, by most accounts, is a guy that was humble. And so like he's not sitting here saying like, oh, glory be to me. No, he's saying glory be to God that these things are happening. I'm not sure I'm doing anything different. And so if I'm not doing anything different, then I guess I just leave a lot on the table as possible, because what if God used this man and this man is, he's still like his life was lived well and still points to God. And if the person heard about Padre Pio and praise, what's the harm, and why can't God still just do the healing thing? You know what I mean? Like, I just
Yeah.
do is there room for to talk about the practice? Yes, but I don't think the conversation dies on the vine at the practice in the way that oftentimes, unfortunately, it just does.
This is the part I have the least problem with. Like actually like coming and saying, yeah, it could God give someone the ability to heal? Sure. I preconception, once again, I already have that in my head. Any true Christian, if God wants them to, can do this, or he does give a select gift of divine healing as a spiritual gift for some people that are, would happen more often than say me. Sure, I'm there. But what I actually was kind of thinking about as you were talking is I was remembering when this is happening. 1918, the 1920s, getting into the 1930s in Italy. Now, if you know your world history, this is a time when Italian fascism is growing, Mussolini is going to be in power. He's going to be obviously allying with, Adolf Hitler in Germany, and then Imperial Japan. So, could God out working outside of time, knowing what's going to happen, have designed a miracle around these parts to bring more people to him in a time where a lot of people are going to proclaim faith but act in the opposite direction? I mean, conspiracy theory? I mean, I'm fine with that idea. Because that makes sense. Could he have left a remnant like he always does? I believe it.
I think there's a I think there's there are no flags to throw when talking about the fact that God knows the end from the beginning. God knows the end from the beginning. And the God that is caring and loving and provides would set the stage for a group of people to stay dedicated to him, or to have a signal, if you will, towards him. I think that makes all of the sense in the world when you equate it up to world history.
Yeah, so I don't really have anything more to say on the healing part of things because like I'm there. I mean that this I mean do I still need to be convinced that it actually happened? Yeah, absolutely. But when you have multiple people saying these things over and over again, well, it's either a well-constructed lie and a great conspiracy or it actually happened. And given what I've seen of this man, he doesn't seem like the kind of person who would want false things attributed to him. But that doesn't mean it can't be true. Like you can fall as a leader, multiple times over, if you let something like fame or ego get to your head. Or it could be something of he had legitimate miracles earlier on, and to keep people there, he faked one or two. Like that could be something that's brought up. I don't think that's what's happening here, but for the sake of being, honest with what's happening, bring it up as a potential reality.
And so the next major set of miracles are called reading hearts. So for those of you that don't know, there is a practice called confession within Catholicism. It is what it is. Do I think that we have that we are we I think we are very quick to swing that pendulum as far and fast as we can when it comes to that, because I think the incredible misstep is to say I don't believe in institutional confession, and say, I don't need to answer to anyone. And I think that is a huge problem that plagues modern Christianity, is the sense of, I don't need to answer to everyone. It's not that you need to be answering to your pastor in a way that it's used against you, weaponized against you. I think I've heard, you know, I've heard some really, really weird missteps when it comes to confession and public confession and all of that sort of stuff. Yes, it's weird. Yes, it's complicated. But I do think that that it's something that requires more nuanced conversation than just a good or bad sticker. But there were repeated claims that confession with Padre Pio was particularly intense because people believed that he could tell when someone was holding something back from him. His Vatican biography emphasizes the sheer scale of this, that he would welcome people to his confessional and counsel for more than 50 years, and he was described as almost besieged by crowds seeking confession and counsel and consolation. It's to a degree that there's like something supernatural happening with his confessional in comparison to others. Up to this point, no notes. I have no problem. This is the one that I'm like, legends are a thing. Living legends are a thing. So more than one thing can be true at the same time, though. So like, if there's an unburdening of the soul that's happening, that the Holy Spirit is making people feel, and all of that sort of stuff, I don't know. Who am I to say it's outside of the realm of the realm of belief for God, or realm of possibility for God? Again, this is so having had limited practice, because I try to be very, like, I always try to be respectful of other denominations, and with Catholicism, there are things that I have learned that I would not want to be disrespectful to the denomination by engaging in the practice, because I am not confirmed as a Catholic. So very limited exposure to this idea of confessional in the standard sense, like in the operational sense, not like specifically just like, oh, I'm talking to a friend, or oh, I'm talking to somebody that I wronged, or something along those lines. So this is the one that, like you were saying about stigmata, because I have a very deep background. Long before I was a Christian, I was a fan of horror, and so like the idea of stigmata was not like that was not weird to me. But this is where my Protestant spider sense starts like the hair on the back of my neck starts to raise. You know what I mean? That I'm just like, the word makes me uncomfortable. I really think that that's where I've got to start the conversation, is that at a base level, before I pour anything into it, my bias shows up exactly with this word.
I get it. We are very guilty of overcorrection in this regard. Yes. My brother and I were talking about it the other day, about how he wishes that the church he was at like had people who would like actually talk to each other about this, like not airing it in front of everyone, not doing dirty laundry, but like being resistant to the idea of confessing sins, because we don't confess sins. We're not Catholic. We're not going to the priest. We go straight to God. And you know what? I think we can go straight to God. I think that's something we all have access to. But I'm also commanded by that same God to then go and confess my sins to others. So, yeah, when you live in a system, as they did for over 1,000 years, where you went directly to your priest and he's the only one who got to know, and you got to you do your Hail Marys and whatever and move on with your life. And then you go, well, wait a minute, that's not exactly how God set things up. So let's abandon that practice. But then you don't replace it with biblical truth. I have an issue with that immensely. And exactly. Protestant church sucks at it, to be perfectly honest. But when it comes to him, like knowing people and be like, hey, like what's actually going on? I don't know if I can. I mean, I'm not saying it can't be, you know, him miraculously reading their mind or having a sense, empathy towards them that like gives them a sense. But I think it just might be he's really good at reading people. And it feels supernatural because they didn't say anything. They didn't think they betrayed something. But one of the things they said may have gone, or he's worked for 50 years in the church. He's recognized, okay, someone 25 years said this. You said the exact same thing. I know your story, buddy. That's where I lean to. I don't discount, once again, that it could be like a supernatural sense of knowing, okay, no, God, you're directing me. This person's not saying what they actually need to say. Let me confront them about this to actually get the true confession.
It's so that's why I say what I say as far as living legend goes. I don't mean to suddenly about face and be disrespectful, but the reality is I think we are I think we are in a point where word of mouth is so a thing and social science is so not a thing yet that understanding somebody's empathetic tendencies or ability to read, I mean, we still talk about mentalists as if they are, you know, con artists, when in all actuality it's just like it's just a skill, you know what I mean? Or like we talk about them like they've got some kind of superpower when it's just a cultivated skill. And I'm not saying that that's what he was, but I am saying that I think that humans' ability to be able to engage in those practices well have been a thing for a very long time. And so I this is one where is it almost looking at it from an exact 180, is this being a thing off the table? No, you got to leave the you got to leave the leave the door open for it. But but again, I think more than one thing can be true at the same time. And so I wouldn't necessarily even look to this one. But again, this might also be the fact that, like I said about the stigmata thing, it's not a miracle that would necessarily resonate with me, and so it doesn't, but that doesn't necessarily invalidate it. It just means that it's not going to resonate with me.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
So I want to, before we close this thing up, talk about one of the high strangeness claims about Padre Pio, and that's stories that people saw him somewhere far away from where he was still reported to be at the friary. There are accounts that obviously are difficult to verify, but do exist that state that they have that folks have had a miraculous or divinely orchestrated encounter with Padre Pio separate from where they're at, and usually that's a, that also is situated closely to some kind of miraculous claim. So like Padre Pio appeared to me or was there and my mother was healed, or I this I had this overwhelming sense that God that God was with me, something along those lines. This is obviously the one that you're gonna have to be like, how can you say one way or the other definitively? You know what I mean? Like, I and that's what that's where, like, if there's anything that you learn from us on a Friday evening, it's that most of the time when you're talking about supernatural stuff, you gotta get comfortable with the idea of like, sure, you know what I mean? Like it's I can't say definitively no, but I certainly am unwilling to say definitively yes, that this is a thing. So yeah, I think do I think that visions from God that don't conflict with the revelation of Christ as we have it are a thing? Sure. I can't say that every single person who's claimed it is lying. So there's that. Again, have I ever experienced it? Not that I would stake my hat on, and not that I think is, you know, there's one that I'm like, oh, I think that this is a that this is a thing. And I would say I'm the most confident that this was a divine a piece of divine inspiration for me to do a particular thing. Now that particular thing, more years on than I want to admit to right this very second, has you know, resulted in in me being married, so there's that. But like it's just I think we have to be I think it's reasonable to say that this could very much fall at least partially into the category of the living legend piece.
Yeah, bilocation is one of those weird things studying it over the years because this has happened multiple times in Catholic history. I can't remember once again proper nouns for the life of me, but I know I want to say it was the 1500s. You had a friar, I'm pretty sure, who was in like Puerto Rico, but also appeared in the Philippines to like talk to a prisoner or something. It's been so long since I've read that. So if I got all that wrong, well, that's on me and my bad memory. But like, this is something that has been studied before, is kind of my point within the Catholic sphere of things, having someone show up in one place together. Like, even looking back into scripture, it's not a one-to-one because it's not what bilocation doesn't happen. But you have the idea of Philip being one place and then being transported somewhere else, you know, to talk to the Ethiopian eunuch and then going back. Could it, he have appeared in both places at once? Maybe it doesn't say so, so I'm not going to say that because I want to be honest to the text. But like to get people's ideas, if you come from a biblical background, you can, oh, he was here, but then he was there. Like, but then change that into he could have been at both places at once. As you said earlier, can I verify that for Padre Pio or any other person this has been claimed about? Absolutely not. I didn't have a camera in one spot and a camera in the other spot saying, well, he's here right now. We dated this at the right time here. No. Is it possible? Yes. I mean, that works within how God can use creation to his own interest. If he has a need for one person to be in two places at once, who am I to say that he can't? But I can't, in good conscience, say, absolutely, this happened, and I'm going to stake everything behind that claim.
And I think that's a healthy position to take. You know what I mean? Like you can't definitively wipe it off the board, but you also cannot definitively state like this is a thing. And then the last major one of note is the odor of sanctity, as it's called. So it's basically a recurring report. Like I said, his wounds had a floral scent to them. I do think it's interesting that there are some reports that say that it was a foul odor, not like a pleasant one. I don't know, but again, it's not one. I think it's one that if true is again part of the lore and legacy of the man, which should end up ultimately reflecting back to God anyway. So like, okay, so the guy smelt like flowers. I think it's more important that he had gaping wounds, you know what I mean? Rather, like, I think that's more pertinent. But yeah, so all in all, an enigmatic man, a man of a lot of notoriety. Not free from controversy, especially, you know, there are prophecies and attributions that are given to him, that are like openly falsely attributed to him. But all in all, by reputation, a man of God, at least it seems. And so I don't know. I think I would classify this one in the realm of more true than untrue. I'll say it like that.
I think that's a fair way of putting it. Like,
Yeah.
I would take, you know, a bullet or two for this one, but I'm not going to take the fatal wound.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Anything else to throw in there before we wrap this thing up?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to, you know, sainthood as a whole, that is another thing I am envious of the Ch Catholic Church for doing, and that they actually do care to instruct people on how people of faith worked in their lives. I mean, we've got our like William Careys and you know, Billy Grahams and so on and so forth. We'll bring up every now and then on our side of things. But like, were you taught them, or did you like someone use it in a sermon once in your life and then maybe you remembered it. Like the Protestant church, once again, kind of sucks in that regard, and that we don't uplift the heroes of the faith. Now, I don't go to the extent the Catholic Church does and say that venerate them in a sense of going directly to them to talk to them or intercede on my behalf to God. There's a reason we split, but I still, once again, cannot say that they're wrong to keep bringing up heroes of the faith who did their jobs and did their jobs well.
Yeah, I would say that that Lutherans are basically the ones that have the market cornered on
Yeah.
the Protestant side of things when it comes to being a part of a larger whole. So yeah, there are things that 1,000% breaking character right now, y'all, because my backyard is a cemetery and there is a moving light in the cemetery right now that I am looking at. Leaving that alone anyway.
A live case study.
Live case study. It's blinking now, guys. Anyway, gonna need to not look at that, otherwise I am not gonna be able to hold my attention right now. Yeah, so I think outside of Lutheranism, you basically have individualism when it comes to Protestantism. We are not like there's a reason why churches that are known for their sense of community are as exceptional as they are considered exceptional, because it's not something that is necessarily really ingrained in a lot of Protestantism. That's not saying all, and so anybody who has an exception to the rule that I just said, awesome. I hope your church is every bit the hub of community that it needs to be, and all of that, great. But like I'm saying, by and large, at scale, we don't experience that. And I think that's part of what plays into the idea of us not really venerating any of our fallen saints, any of our anybody who came before us outside of like some notable people. But even then, you're talking about celebrities, and a lot of the time, at some point, you are gonna end up pointing to some kind of controversy around them and all of that. And now you can make the argument, oh, they're just humans, and so they're not perfect. That's a true statement, but actions still have consequences, and people still need to be held responsible. That's all I'm saying. Anyway. So yeah, I mean, I think that people like this should be remembered, regardless of where you fall on the safe thing, regardless of whether or not you think that there is a specific place in the divine hierarchy for these fallen saints. But I also am the type of person that I openly use the word saints, because it's not just a Catholic word, guys. They
Yes.
mean something specific about it, and so you need to be authentic to what they mean by that. But like that's not the only definition of the phrase. And so I think it's important for us to categorize it with authenticity, but also don't be so hard pressed to try and debunk something like this that you lose sight on the idea that what we're talking about is a man of God operating within a faith that in a God that our Bible very much dictates could do this stuff, like could do these things. Now your mileage may vary and what you think is true and what's not, but there's it is not contradictory to the Bible to say that at least some of this stuff could happen.
Yeah. I mean, like, honestly, when Joe first pitched this idea to me, I was on the more skeptical side of things, just off from what I remembered from before. But actually looking into it and, learning other things live here, I switched. I mean, I'm still not completely on, 100% Team Padre Pio, always being authentic and everything. But you know what? I'm way closer than I thought I'd be at the end of this. And that's because I actually spent time digging into it instead of just bringing my preconceptions to it.
And I hope that if nothing else, that this is an invitation for you all to, for those of you that are Christians that are watching this, that you take the invitation that this to explore outside of your comfort zone, to explore outside of the area that feels safe, and allow yourself to be exposed to the things that make your Protestant hair, the hair on the back of your neck stand up. You know what I mean? That trigger you, or things like that, because you might, that does not guarantee that you are going to walk out of that exchange suddenly believe in something that you didn't believe before. That's not what we're saying here. What we are saying, though, is that you may be exposed to a concept that you weren't, that glorifies God that you were otherwise shut off from because of bias against a particular group of people. So, y'all, we are, that's it. That's all. That's a wrap for this time. So, we are, if you are new to Friday Night Frights, we do this most months, every month. That
Asterisk.
and we wrote, huh?
Asterisk.
Yeah, asterisk. So we so and every month the topic rotates. So Christian, what is on the docket for the schedule for next month, at least for
I
temporary?
believe we are going to be on the weird and the unexplained, which is kind of a catch-all for anything that doesn't really fit, or even something that does fit, and we just want to talk about that instead, the other categories. So it's kind of a grab bag.
If you are new to the world of systematic ecology, Anna Zhao Ministries podcast network, or any of those sorts of things, or if you are coming over from the KFM broadcasting world, there is a Facebook group called the Priest to the Geeks that you can look up on Facebook, join, if especially if you are looking for your voice to be heard dictating what we cover, because we do polls there. It's how you can stay up to date with everything going on with the variety of shows within the Anna Zhao network. So anything else before we close it down?
No, thank you guys for everything you do. Just feel free to share the show wherever. We're always happy to have more people come to the live streams and ask questions. We'll be sure to give you your time in the sun.
All right, y'all. Stay spooky, and we'll catch you next time.